Thank you for coming. To write in winter is a contrary endeavour, an act of resistance. It involves crossing the season's picket line to access the icy workshop, creating lifelike things when so much of what is living is being taken away, rubbing the hands together for warmth when the cold has entered the bones, and striking sparks into damp kindling when the planet has turned its face from the light. It's a contradiction poetry has not been able to resist. Mine is a mistimed subject, given the weather for the Hillary lecture, as anyone who skied or tobogganed to this building on the first day of March this year will appreciate. And the snow, lying deep and crisp and even on the college lawns, crusting the keep off the grass signs, might have been taken as an unseasonal meteorological event in itself, if our cold spells didn't appear to be coming later and later every winter, if they come at all. So apologies for not taking advantage of that bad weather by delivering this talk in collaboration with the Beast from the East. It's just that these lectures take me months to prepare, and if I could bang out 7,500 words about the first thing I see when I pull back the curtains, I wouldn't be a poet. I'd be a professional blogger. And this sentence would be followed by an advert for chilblain cream and thermal vests. Poetry is a contemplative art. More on this later. During the actual winter, by which I mean the old-fashioned calendric winter, when the nights of lowest temperatures and the days of longest darkness used to reliably coincide, I reread Tape for the Turn of the Year by the American poet A.R. Ammons. I've spoken before and elsewhere about how I became drawn to mid-century American poetry, finding it a breath of fresh air compared to the clubby standoffishness of certain strains of British poetry of the same era. The fresh air being the frontier of the empty page, there to be explored and adventured along, and the breath being the proximity of the written word to the spoken language, where colloquial registers, local rhythms, and quirks of dialect were celebrated front and centre, rather than being tolerated as eccentric outbursts or stifled altogether. What I heard and what excited me was the voice rather than the intellect. And although Ammons wasn't by any means the most vernacular or demotic of his peers, and in some instances one of its more cerebral practitioners, I fell originally for the languid conversational charms of his poem Corson's Inlet. Having released himself from the burden of form, from what he calls the perpendiculars, straight lines, blocks, boxes, binds of thought, the poet continues his free verse wandering and wondering along the New Jersey shoreline, relieved that the overall is beyond me, liberated from the responsibilities of summary and conclusion we associate with the bards of yore. The titles to the poems in Tape for the Turn of the Year, which are really subtitles in the form of dates, imply entries in a poetic journal beginning on the 6th of December 1964 and ending on the 10th of January 1965. A continuous daily record with the exceptions of Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, when we might assume Ammons had other claims on his time and or other things on his mind, and December the 29th. I approached the collection as if it were a kind of advent calendar, dutifully opening each poetic window on its corresponding date and encountering entries ranging from half a page to a dozen or more pages in length, often commencing with a matter-of-fact weather report. Harold Bloom said of A.R. Ammons that his poetry helps me to live my life. Quite a claim. And crudely speaking, I suppose I wondered if it could do the same for me, either emotionally or practically on a day-by-day basis. But it isn't the diarized format that gives the poem its energy and frisson so much as its means of production. By which I mean the roll of adding machine tape on which Ammons composed. The poet acknowledges to his readers and to himself the potentially synthetic and gimmicky nature of such an approach in the opening section, confessing, "I'm attracted to paper. Visualize kitchen napkins scribbled with little masterpieces. So it was natural for me in the house and garden store one night a couple of weeks ago to contemplate this roll of adding machine tape, so narrow, long, unbroken, and to penetrate into some full use for it. I thought of the poem then, but not seriously. Now, 2 weeks have gone by, and the muse hasn't rejected it, seems caught up in the serious novelty." A serious novelty indeed, determinedly quotidian and playfully mundane at times, introspective, philosophical, and melancholic at others. The tape, with its finite but unknown length, representing an exploration of stamina and dedication, as well as imposing unusually slender constraints on the emerging poem. It's a limitation that forces Ammons into making spontaneous and improvised decisions in regard to line breaks and layout as he slaloms down a seamless page about 3 inches in width, the colons he prefers to full stops, emphasizing the continuous forward motion of the exercise. That mention of house and garden might seem throwaway, but actually sets up one of the poem's ongoing dichotomies between the domestic life of the writer, much in evidence here, and the world through the window, the outside where winter sets in, into which the restless imagination and sometimes the body must roam, and from where they must return. In that respect, Tape is a long poem of inner and outer journeys, with the Commedia and the Aeneid and Piers Plowman and even the Pilgrim's Progress as shadow narratives. But in terms of its quest for home and the meaning of home, always with Odysseus as a travelling companion. In the poem's only direct quote, and in staccato one-word lines, Ammons' wife Phyllis becomes a sardonic but nevertheless telling Penelope when she calls her husband to the table, saying, "You can come sit down now if you want to." Odysseus' journey to the underworld also seems present in several passages via the occasionally elegiac or funereal tone. On December 29th, the third of the missing dates, Ammons couldn't keep his rendezvous with his muse because he attended a memorial service to William Carlos Williams in New York, which he describes the following day. Earlier, on December the 8th, Ammons watches a violent storm on the Atlantic horizon and ruminates on the nature of fate and prophecy. The following day, he reports how a plane carrying 80 people was brought down by the distant weather. Spontaneously, and as if turning to the adding machine paper for its intended and dispassionate use, Ammons then presses down on the one key 80 times until a cemetery of upright digits or unmarked graves has reached its tally, each figure registering an anonymous embodiment or memorializing a lost life through an expression of cold numerical fact. Elsewhere, Ammons is an unacknowledged Theseus, equipped with Ariadne's thread. using the tape to navigate his way in and out of the labyrinth of winter and through the dark tunnels of his thoughts. It's hard to do justice to the poem by simply talking about it. There's something experiential in its flow and direction, something in the silent reading of it that reproduces the process and processes of its construction. All the self-conscious wobbles and existential balancing acts that must have taken place as Ammons negotiated the treadmill of the page, or performed his poetic log-rolling act with the spool disappearing beneath him. And nowhere are those feelings more present than when the poet notices a red edging to the paper, indicating that time is running out, and sees the end of the roll lifting from the floor, rising to meet him. The peculiarly extruded poem has served as a handrail or safety rope through the dead of winter into spring, but the death of the poem waits at the far end. I wouldn't want to give the impression that all I did during those short days between the end of 2017 and the beginning of 2018 was read, or that all I read was poetry, or that the only poet I read was A.R. Ammons. Even if my daily appointments with tape for the turn of the year had the intensity and sometimes claustrophobia of a waking hibernation, of deliberately joining the poet in his slow journey through the gloomy underpass. Though when I did open other books, it was mainly with the intention of complementing or complicating and sometimes contradicting the experience with other winter poems. I emerged from that literary igloo, or rather was woken from it by angry outbursts from around the poetry world. After what seemed like a period of truce and even a permanent ceasefire, hostilities between the forces of the page and the forces of the stage had recommenced. In a dispute over poetic territory and across freshly opened fronts, insults were being traded, slurs exchanged, and snipers had taken up advantageous positions. The inciting incident, under the heading "The Cult of the Noble Amateur," was a piece in PN Review by poet critic Rebecca Watts, lambasting the writings of a cohort of young female poets who are currently being lauded by the poetic establishment for their honesty and accessibility, buzzwords for the open denigration of intellectual engagement and rejection of craft that characterizes their work. The response and counter-response, and especially the media response, reminded me of dust-ups in the school playground, when a crowd would quickly encircle any outbreak of violence, clapping gleefully and chanting, "Fight, fight, fight," the size of the audience always in reverse proportion to the issues at stake, i.e., the more trivial the conflict, the more entertaining the spectacle. To that end, this particular spat even made the world at one. Suburbs in the Middle East were being pulverized through aerial bombardment, and patients were rotting on hospital trolleys in the corridors of A&E departments across Britain. But what could be more gripping than a war of words about a subject 99% of the public doesn't care tuppence about? It was the "and finally" slot, usually the preserve of surfers rescued several miles off the Cornish coast, or dogs that can say the word sausages. I promised myself that I wouldn't go stumbling into the kill zone wearing a neon target on my forehead, but wanted to make a few comments about the great rumpus, insofar as it overlaps with some of my themes today and my thinking in general. Because I found myself, to some extent, if not agreeing with, then understanding both sides of the argument. And even though I don't exactly hold dual citizenship between those two territories, I have operated on either side of the line and of comrades in both camps. The world of performance poetry and spoken word, insofar as I have experienced it, is a generous, supportive, and inclusive one. By which I mean, it encourages participation and places a high value on contribution and involvement. In that environment, I've never heard one practitioner openly criticize the work of another. By the same token, there seems to be no definition of bad work based on linguistic decision-making, only bad timing or poorly developed aspects of stagecraft. In that world, the worst crime would be to say something socially unacceptable. It's a scene where values and attitudes tend to be subconsciously agreed in advance, and where the poetry is often a public confirmation of shared beliefs. And being audience rather than reader-oriented, the work lives or dies by the immediate responses it elicits. Its obligations are primarily to the moment, which is why it has so much in common with the entertainment business and with stand-up comedy. In that context, delivery is everything. Tone of voice, physical posture, facial gesture, verbal flexibility, wardrobe choice, and so on and so forth. Performance, in other words, hence its well-earned label. This is borne out by the hitherto inconceivable popularity of spoken word poets on YouTube and other social media sites. It isn't just that their work has radically bypassed or sidestepped traditional gatekeeping mechanisms in literature. It's because theirs is an audio-visual art. The printed and published form of such work is, generally speaking, a secondary consideration, perhaps even an afterthought, a little bit like a play script program on sale at the theatre, i.e. the words, but without the actors to dramatise them. Or perhaps the equivalent of printed song lyrics. And to that end, the spoken word scene also has close relations with the music business, with some of its leading lights and their promoters and contractual riders having more in common with recording artists than with published authors. Writers of poetry, the page poets, are the willing inheritors of a tradition that goes back thousands of years, whose skills and ambitions are adapted to the inscribed and printed surfaces and to the evolved criteria by which written and published poetry is judged. Which is why they're so bad at reading their work out loud, the performance poets might claim. And performance poets, for all their anti-establishment credentials and radical chic, are actually the inheritors of a tradition that goes back tens of thousands of years, whose skills and ambitions are directed towards the instantaneous reaction of a live audience. Which is why their work is so lame on paper, the writer-poets might observe, and so on and so forth. None of which is particularly controversial. Poetry is a broad church. You pay your money and you take your choice. Hackles rise, however, when work produced for one context is delivered into another, a context that has markedly different expectations and definitions of worth. Or to be more case-specific, when work by spoken word artists / performance poets appears on a poetry list associated with determinedly written poetry, and in the company of poets who have spent most of their life trying to find ways of avoiding a poetry of transparent design and telegraphed desires. Money is certainly a factor, and subsidy an unspoken theme, though it's a two-way transaction. Lucrative stage poetry bailing out page poetry through robust sales and cash-strapped publishing imprints, loaning hard-earned literary prestige in return. What can't speak can't lie, stage poetry insists. Your sales are laughable, whereas ours has moved the decimal point several places to the right. To which page poetry, recalling its ambivalence to popularity and its oath of obstinacy, replies, "We rest our case." But look at the crowds, page poetry argues. It's what people want. It's called democracy. Page poetry replies, "Sure, but people also gathered to watch Titanic the movie. They stood in line to meet Mr. Blobby." "You've got the social skills of a lump of wood," one side tweets. "You wouldn't know subtlety if it hit you over the head with a sledgehammer," comes the editorial retort. And on it goes, and on it went, those winter words of various moods and meters. The compliments of the season? I think not. I turn back to the darkness and to A.E. Houseman. If many biographical accounts are to be believed, Houseman was an unlovable individual, an intellectual snob and dedicated misanthropist who emitted a virtually tangible air of disapproval and existed within an almost visible aura of unapproachability. His would seem an inflammatory presence to introduce into this squabble to both parties, I suspect. Frog-marched along to the T.S. Eliot readings or Poetry International, for example, I imagine him sitting at the back of an auditorium in a pose of expressive isolation, rolling his eyes and harumphing at the half-witted attempts of today's supposed literary heavyweights. Press-ganged into witnessing a performance poetry gig or spoken word happening, I picture him in the wings of a stage or standing in a muddy field, regurgitating his elevenses. I see him in this hall today, or rather, the empty chair where he sat for a few seconds, already on a train and halfway back to Cambridge. But even when Houseman was trying to be as disagreeable as possible, it's difficult not to agree with some of his observations. His 1933 Leslie Stephen lecture being one example. Better known by its title, The Name and Nature of Poetry, in its closing paragraphs, the lecture departs from the usual customs and courtesies of academic objectivity as Houseman describes his own writing practice, beginning with a pint of beer at luncheon, followed by a 2 or 3 hour walk, looking at things around me and following the progress of the season, during which poetic thoughts would sometimes and unaccountably bubble up. We're familiar with his description of poetry as a morbid secretion from earlier in the same lecture, but this is poetry as a gaseous emission, and if his remarks were judged vulgar and inappropriate at the time, I can only assume that was part of Houseman's general mischievousness. Likewise, and continuing with the gaseous emission analogy, if the wider tone of his oration was designed to get up the noses of those in the audience, it seemed to have worked. I.A. Richards was reported as saying that it would take poetry 12 years to mend the damage that Houseman had caused in an hour. An anecdote that Houseman was pleased to record and repeat. His headline points, however, such as they are identifiable, are persuasive and pertinent. Poetry as a subject is impossible to define, he maintains, or rather, the legitimate use of the word were themselves so many as to embarrass the discussion of its nature. That we shouldn't compound the confusion by attaching to it writing not worthy of its name. The 18th century couldn't write poetry, Houseman tells us, breezily dismissing 100 years worth of the likes of Dryden and Pope because cleverness had got in the way. A repressing intelligence and snivelling wit that meant poetry could not describe natural objects with sensitive fidelity to nature and could not express human feelings with a variety and delicacy answering to their own. 3 centuries later, the poetry of learned scholars is still disadvantaged by the emphasizing of erudition over articulation. Ironically, poetry that goes out of its way to be anti-intellectual also suffers from similar reasons when it privileges the message over the means. Poetry is not the thing said, but the way of saying it, pronounces Houseman, finally getting to his point. If that's controversial or opens up the possibility of some uncomfortable truths, it's a discomfort I recognize. A bad poem isn't just unconvincing. It actually provokes in the sensitive reader an antipathy towards the very idea being expressed, no matter how acceptable the subject matter or how laudable its standpoint. Equally, on those occasions when I've read a poem whose outlook I disagree with or even find obnoxious, a well-turned phrase or felicitous construction of language conjures a positive response somewhere in the neural pathways. So if you want me to sign a petition against the unnecessary felling of trees in the Sheffield suburbs, don't write a clumsy sonnet or some shouty protest piece about a sycamore. Psychologically, I'm going to turn up with a chainsaw. Instead, lure some hapless council bureaucrat into composing an excruciating ode on the dangers of falling branches and the health and safety implications of tree roots protruding through pavements in residential areas, and I'll be there on the barricades. I'll be hammocked in the boughs. Requested to supply a definition of poetry, I think by an American publication, Houseman says, I replied that I could no more define poetry than a terrier can define a rat, but that I thought we both recognized the object by the symptoms it provokes in us. His example of this kind of instinctive and unstoppable canine rodent identification, he gives as the 7th verse of the 49th Psalm of the Book of Common Prayer. But no man may deliver his brother, nor make agreement unto God for him. Of which Houseman wrote, that is to me poetry so moving that I can hardly keep my voice steady in reading it. Another much repeated example of the aloof scholar poet expressing his emotions in public was recalled by a former student who remembered Houseman ending a lecture with a reading of one of Horace's odes followed by his own translation. That I regard as the most beautiful poem in ancient literature, said Houseman, allegedly, apparently on the brink of tears before he left the room. The poem was Odes 4-7, De Fugere Neves, which in Houseman's version begins, the snows are fled away, leaves on the shores and grasses in the mead renew their birth. The river to the riverbed withdraws, and altered is the fashion of the earth. If the anecdote is to be believed, and if Houseman was a practitioner of his preachings, then it's the wording and rhythm of the original, rather than the outright meaning, which he found so appealing. As someone illiterate in 1st century BC Latin, it's an experience I can't share or comment on, though with just a pocket dictionary and a decent internet connection, I can determine that his translation is somewhat free, as poet-to-poet translations must be, and certainly has enough poetic agency and authority of its own to activate Horace's argument. In a lesser poem, for example, Wordsworth's scandalously cheerful Written in March, the arrival of spring stirs the spirits in the poet's breast and is a straightforward augury of health and happiness to come. Like an army defeated, the snow hath retreated, carols the optimistic romantic. In Horace, the green shoots of spring are but memento mori. The world renews, but man doesn't, and false hope is what lies beneath the blanketing whiteness. The changing year's successive plan proclaims mortality to man, is how Samuel Johnson renders its moral lesson, reorganizing Horace's dactylic quatrains into clanging couplets of parade ground iambic tetrameter, quick, clean and clever, but endorsing Houseman's point about the 18th century favoring the brain over the soul. In fact, the true virtuosity of the poem lies in its slide from the pastoral to the interpersonal, albeit via mainly mythological characters. In Houseman's version, it concludes, "And Theseus leaves Pirithous in the chain the love of comrades cannot take away." Lines presumably haunted by Moses Jackson, the unciprecating love of Houseman's life, to whom the poet was perpetually shackled and from whom he was permanently bereaved. Odes 4:7 opens as a flower might, waking to the spring, full of the equivalent poetic promise, but we have been deliberately misled. The snow was an anesthetizing, numbing element, and sensation, when it returns, brings with it painful truths, as painful as a returning memory after Eliot's forgetful snow. We know from the sentence making in Thomas Hardy's prose how well he could fashion a clause or paragraph, and how smooth and clear the words could run in his shaping of narrative, or in his observations of action, or in his portrayals of character. First and foremost, the readers of his novels wanted story and plot, but having satisfied their needs and the demands of his publishers, Hardy indulged his own preferences as a writer, initially in the off hours and by moonlight, and eventually to the exclusion of prose altogether. And the poems feel to be developed out of a different lexicon. As if in constructing verse, Hardy reached for a different dictionary on a higher shelf. Or perhaps like most poets, Hardy was simply aware how conspicuous and exposed poetic language becomes on the page. It sounds odd to say this of a man born in 1840, but Hardy's poetic diction was always somewhat old-fashioned, and his delivery could on occasions, as Tom Paulin has noted, carry the glib sonority of a young man trying to sound old and disillusioned. It was a poetic tone he maintained across the better part of 7 decades, and one that he grew to fit. So by the time of his death in 1928, his quirky grammar and peculiar vocabulary seemed not so much archaic as arcane, the idiolect of an eccentric genius with a biblical eye for lesson and parable, writing in a language of which he was the last surviving speaker and to which only he was entitled. Yeats and Frost seemed modernist by comparison. I see Hardy the poet as a kind of cottage industry cabinet maker, using inherited tools and time-honored techniques, operating alone in a lean-to workshop behind the house, someone with a devotional respect for the materials he worked with and whose products were antiques the minute they left the workbench and the varnish had dried. If all that makes Hardy sound like a servant to the perpendiculars, straight lines, blocks, boxes, binds of thought, as Ammons put it, and a disciple to the set square geometries of his architectural training. It was his knack of incorporating reclaimed timbers and found materials into his designs that separated him from other craftspeople of his time. Those eccentric inclusions come in the form of words like chancefulness and undecreased and powerfuller, words that warrant a ticking off from Microsoft's spell check function and feel as if they belong to some provincial and uncorrupted dialect of Middle Earth. Those three examples are all taken from his first collection, Wessex Poems and Other Verses, published in 1898. But unnoting and deedily and the near unpronounceable presciencelessness from his posthumously published volume, Winter Words in Various Moods and Meters, prove he was still at it right to the end. And the consistency worked in both directions, in the sense that the various moods and meters could apply to every period of Hardy's poetic output and all of his collections. The moods being anything from joy to misery, though mostly misery, and with Hardy, always ready and willing to jump between autobiographical incidents and third-person recollections, between real-time observations and recalled anecdotes, and between personal confession and dramatic monologue or dialogue, though the voice is always recognisably his. As for the meters he worked in, they're as numerous as the physical shapes of the poems on the page, but it's the metrical variation within the poems, as much as between them, that sets Hardy apart. To express this in terms of the cabinet-making metaphor, if Hardy's symmetrical and right-angled stanzas are the solid oak drawers in a bureau or dresser, and his rhymes are the dovetails and wooden dowels and mitered corners by which the structures interlock, and his trademark indents are the decorative scrollwork and bevels, then it's the rhythmical subtlety within the poems that represent his individuality and stop him becoming the automaton apprentice to some great master or house of design, producing piece after piece of indistinguishable perfection. So even though the eye perceives something of proportion and measure in a Hardy poem, the ear recognizes a more nuanced construction. Rarely do the poems stride along to the repeated and regular bang of the drum from beginning to end. And where rhythms do form a sort of backbeat, careful word choice leads to restrained and understated subversions. Almost any poem would serve as an illustration, but from Winter Words, let's take Throwing a Tree, a poem that combines a sort of lumberjack's instruction manual with a present tense blow-by-blow account of an actual tree being felled, inviting a methodical, systematic, operational approach on the one hand, while at the same time needing to stay alive and alert to the unfolding events of the here and now. Accordingly, once line one has girded its loins, it canters along in enthusiastic dactyls, the two executioners stalk along over the knolls, or in animated anapests, which might seem an odd thing to say, the falling, trailing dactyl being the very opposite of the rising, escalating anapest. But meter in verse is conditional, everything dependent on where the counting starts and stops, and what kind of metrical status the hypermetric syllables at the beginning or end of the line are afforded. If anyone tells you that scansion is an exact science, they're lying. It's an interpretive one. Just as sprung rhythm isn't a way of writing, it's a way of reading. But no matter, all you need to note here is the dit-dit-da, dit-dit-da, or the da-dit-dit-da-dit-dit frequency at the heart of the line, and to recognize that line two sets out in the same way until it reaches those alliterating heavy heads of the axe. A more regimented reader could still bully the line across the phrase heavy heads in the same meter, but the two words together have a combined weight which Hardy wants us not just to understand, but to feel. So those sensitive to the stresses of spoken language will slow up to honour the two accented H's, and accordingly, something of the gravity and mass of the weapon is conveyed. The same thing happens with tall giant in the first line of verse 3. Only by verbal oppression will the word giant submit to two unstressed syllables and conform to the prevailing metrical pattern. But in letting the phrase speak with its natural rhythm and inherent emphases, we pause for a moment, heads back, gazing up in wonder at the height of the tree. Even in a more explicitly rhythmical poem like Drummer Hodge, where lines of four iambic feet alternate with lines of three iambic feet throughout the three sestets, Hardy's delicate or determined word choices foil any attempts to let the rhythm ride roughshod throughout. A tempo is maintained, yes, but it's his use of the soft and loud pedals that prevent that tempo becoming a metronome or a click track. All that variousness, as Hardy might have put it, of mood and meter, and of guise and disguise, comes neatly packaged in another Winter Words poem, which also rather conveniently ties in with my characterization of Hardy as the village carpenter. In The Three Tall Men, a long-limbed man builds himself a suitably long-limbed coffin, a long coffin, a preemptive move triggered by the unsettling experience of watching his tall father being squeezed into a humiliating small casket. But the long coffin is required for the burial of his tall brother, and a second long coffin is required for the burial of his tall son, and a third long coffin is never put to use because the tall coffin maker drowns at sea. Hardy ramps up the melodrama by presenting the poem as a series of rumours. The speaker doesn't witness the drowning, but receives news of it second hand, and the coffin building is never directly observed, only heard through a wall as a series of ghostly tappings, and delivered in the form of a gossipy dialogue. In some respects, The Three Tall Men is typically Hardy-esque. Fate not just confounding the best-laid plans of a well-organized mortal, but lobbing in a quantity of humiliating irony for good measure. The tappings format, reminiscent of a knock-knock joke, and the poem's length and formula extending it into shaggy dog territory. But for all its costume theatricality, by the time the poem was being readied for publication, having increased in size from the manuscript version entitled Two Tall Men, the octogenarian Hardy had himself lived through the loss of his elders, most of his peers, and millions of sons in various theatres of war across the world. And the personal implications of the poem are enhanced by an image of the aging Hardy contemplating his own literary legacy. Look beyond the ghoulish entertainment, and here is a poem which cautions against any attempt to secure a posthumous reputation. A fable about a man who designed a structure capable of housing his impressive stature in the future, when really he should have been building a vessel for the present. In a further interpretation, The Three Tall Men can be read as a subversive denial of the Holy Trinity and a sacrilegious parable on the theme of bespoke crucifixions and custom-built martyrdoms, not to mention a certain larger-than-life individual who squandered the carpentry talents handed down to him by his stepfather for the pursuit of religious celebrity. But that's another story for another time. Hardy correctly predicted Winter Words as being probably my last appearance on the literary stage. And for stage, read page. But the Winter Words I really want to ponder come from his previous collection, Human Shows, Far Fantasies, Songs and Trifles. The later volumes form a lesser studied area of Hardy's output, at least in comparison with the guilt-ridden poems from Satires of Circumstance, occasioned by the death of his first wife, Emma Gifford, or the early pieces that have the big subjects of war, religion, and politics more directly in their sights. That said, the weather in Hardy is nearly always portent and symbol, and often plays a political role. After centuries of land grabbing by the aristocratic and the elite, and given continuing fashions among the gentry for transforming heaths and wetlands into croquet lawns and boating lakes, the unpredictable and ungovernable character of the skies and seasons is a rascally and rebellious presence in the work, an irrepressible voice, and one which speaks with the elemental authority of the natural world, redressing the haughty chatter of the metropolis. Human Shows isn't entirely seasonally ordered, but the position of dozens of weather-related poems suggests the calendar as a rough template for the collection. So progress through autumn might be monitored by keeping a close eye, a weather eye, shall we say, on the leaves on the trees as they turn, then drop, then rot. In Last Week in October, a spider's web on tenterhooks acts as an early warning system. Winter's alarm triggered by a falling leaf that dangles like a convict on a noose, mumming in golden garb. Another leaf, still green and innocent, shudders at the prospect. If the personification is heavy-handed, the implications are even less subtle. Death comes to all, and the loftiest and least grounded among us will have the furthest to fall. And in drawing a parallel between expiry by natural causes and a public hanging, it feels as if Hardy has anticipated Yeats's Man Has Created Death declaration by 4 or 5 years, as the only creature in the universe, as far as we know, to be acutely aware of our own mortality. The idea of passing away becomes a self-imposed execution, a death sentence we have handed down on ourselves. By the poem The Later Autumn, 2 poems further in, all the leaves of the previous year have become corpses on the floor, and this year's crop are in the process of joining them. With an appetite for the worm and the maggot, the opportunist robin eyes the scene. This is Hardy, the consummate ghoul, never better than when he's mooching about in the leaf litter of human misfortune, always a willing messenger when it comes to delivering bad tidings, particularly if the message can be conveyed with a little twist of the knife, in this case by recasting the chirpy robin, the so-called gardener's friend, and a cliched mascot of a cliched winter, as a vulture. By nighttime in mid-fall, Hardy is in full gothic mode. During a storm-strid night, the falling leaves are the very least of it. This time the roots of the trees are writhing and wrenching below ground, and in a parallel image in the second verse, those roots have become a most slimy and slippery creature. Stirred from their streams, eels wriggle out of the turbulent water and cross the road, an event folks haven't just observed, but have experienced physically. Walking home late at night, with the animals squelching under their feet and slithering around their ankles. And this isn't the time or place to address Hardy's much-debated attitude towards religion, but the final line, "Church timbers creak and witches ride abroad," juxtaposing a creaking ecclesiastical structure and rampant sorcery, deserves a paragraph of response. The poet John Wayne, a former professor at this lectern, said of Hardy, "He described himself as an agnostic, but he was in many ways closer to being an atheist in the high Victorian manner, combining disbelief in God with a venomous dislike of him for not existing." To my mind, Hardy seemed to find religion not only tolerable, but a necessary part of the social fabric, especially in rural or provincial communities where its customs and traditions formed part of a benign code of living. Once in a while, he also allowed himself to be beguiled and seduced by the magic of religion, as at the end of his poem, "The Oxen," when he acknowledges the persuasive power of the nativity story and his willingness to be drawn along by it. But at the institutional level, religion attracts his distrust and disdain. His famous poem, "In Church," in which an egotistical clergyman is caught reenacting a performance that thrilled his congregation, has a universal message on the theme of human vanity. But its theatricality of Christian worship and the hypocrisy of its doctrines and dogma, which are really being lampooned. Generally speaking, Hardy seems to say that if there is a deity, which there probably isn't, he's not a deliberately cruel or vengeful one. But in a frozen-hearted and unresponsive universe, it's the unsuspecting and innocent who will suffer most. Stock characters in his novels and poems. Those autumnal pieces, interleaved, can I say, through the first third of Human Shows, brings us eventually to a more intense period of cold weather, Hardy's own tape for the turn of the year sequence, a sort of poetic mini ice age in the form of six consecutive pieces numbered 701 to 706 in Gibson's Complete Poems. I've discussed the poised ambiguity of the last line of "Snow in the Suburbs" in a previous lecture, and on this occasion, I'm interested in the transformative effect of the snow. Following the increasingly bleak conditions and gloomy atmospheres of the preceding poems, the arrival of winter in its most austere garb might have heralded misery and despair on a whole new level, but elicits instead a considerate human-to-animal gesture, as if this pure and primary expression of nature had bestowed an unexpected tenderness on the urban environment and softened the heart of its residents. The original manuscript title suggests the poem is set in Hardy's neighbourhood in Upper Tooting, with David's villa in Hook Road, Surbiton, another contender. Either location dates the event to the late 1870s. Hardy was recently married at that time, and although the poem doesn't necessarily belong to that body of self-recriminatory work I referred to earlier, it carries the same romanticized view of the past and an idealized sense of companionship. The homely and cozy "we" in the last line, a declaration of domestic harmony. The joint decision to bring the cat in from the cold, proclaiming a partnership of agreed sensitivities. If "Snow in the Suburbs" was deliberately intended as a bright beginning to the short suite of winter poems, "The Frozen Greenhouse," five poems later, is its morose counterpart, an example of frost having a curious effect on my mind, as Hardy put it in a letter to Florence Henniker, foretelling something of a tragic nature. No illuminating and dazzling snow on this occasion, just a murderous frigidity that kills the plants in the conservatory one night when someone neglects to light the stove. Go through, Mr. Hardy. Dr. Freud will see you now. The poem recalls a conversation between Hardy and Emma Gifford during Hardy's visit to St. Juliet Church. It's a first date poem, and the deceased plants, iced, cold, forgot, become conveniently ironic divinations for a love that would lose its heat, for a wife now lying cold in her grave, for a poet binging on literary remorse, his own spousal numbness of previous years now commuted to the literal numbness of Emma's body and mind. The last three lines show Hardy at his sharpest and some might say cruelest. The terse diction, the flat factual statements, the curt and clipped rhymes of got and not, the simultaneous display of compassion and control, and a chilling sense of the cool detachment which is both his subject and his means of enactment. Between the contrasting bookends of snow in the suburbs and the frozen greenhouse lie four more winter poems, equally various in their mood and meter and in their interpretation of climatic conditions. In Ice on the Highway, we encounter several women arm in arm, sliding and laughing their way along the glassy road underfoot. It's a poem describing a glad and giddy scene, the women happy despite the weather. But read in combination with the frozen greenhouse, it's a poem of distant observation, Hardy witnessing joyful sisterly companionship from the position of an excluded onlooker. Of the three other poems, two concern music and the inherited significance of music in Hardy's life and writing. In Shakespeare, at night, in midsummer, the forest is a place of magic and enchantment. In Hardy's Winter Night in Woodland, the darkness is populated not by star-crossed lovers and roguish fairy folk, but by hunters, gamekeepers, poachers, snarers, and smugglers. Shadowy figures involved in shady activities, yes, but real-life people of the countryside looking to put food on the table at a time of scarcity and hardship. However, on the stroke of midnight, songs are heard, chorused by named members of the Mellstock Choir from under the greenwood tree. In Hardy's words, they sing worn carols, brought on the air from dim distance. It's a distance of time as much as place, the same distance that separates the troupe of passionless and penniless fiddle players in Music in a Snowy Street from the haze, crotchets, quavers, and old notes that Hardy associates with merrymaking and dancing when life was no trial. In both poems, music rouses in Hardy a sentimental nostalgia for the old days and the old ways. Winter is more of a backdrop or stage set for these poems, though against its sparseness and colourlessness, it feels as if Hardy's senses are made keener, the nerves laid bare, the eye quick for the detail, and his ear tuned to faraway noises, even to individual voices in songs being chorused by invisible members of an imaginary choir from one of his own early novels, their harmonies spanning the divide even between poetry and prose. Time is also the subject of the final poem I want to discuss, the one in which winter weather is more explicitly included and integral to its meaning. It's difficult with Hardy, or at least I have found it difficult, to accurately date the poems, and difficult to know how contemporaneous the poems are to their originating circumstances. As with Music in a Snowy Street, published in 1925, but presumably a version of a scene he observed on the 26th of April, 1884, and recorded in his self-ghosted biography. For that reason, I can't say for certain if a light snowfall after frost, despite the near Surbiton postscript, is one of projection or one of reflection, hardly commenting on the aging process from a position of anticipation or experience. But with personal conviction, what I can say is that it's one of Hardy's finest pieces, an exquisitely judged, enigmatically sequenced, and expertly crafted conceit. And if Houseman struggled to recite from one of the Psalms without his voice betraying his response, I have the same problem with the first verse of A Light Snowfall After Frost, which reads, "On the flat road, a man at last appears. How much his whitening hairs owe to the settling snow's mute anchorage, and how much to a life's rough pilgrimage, one cannot certify." I won't even begin to unpack the orchestrated emotional intelligence of the diction, the grammar, the symbolism, the cadencing, the ordering of ideas, the physicalization on the page, the rhymes and the puns of those five magnificently composed lines. That would be an entire lecture. But to consider the poem as a whole, here we find Hardy moved and enlightened by a change in the weather. The frost, which we might read as a frosty outlook, is replaced by a soft and silent transfiguring snow, prompting introspective responses from the poet. If the first traveller on the road of life has the appearance of an older man, the fiery red beard and tree-green coat lend the second traveller a youthful vigour and vitality, though the coat is faded and the word die carries an echo of its morbid homophone. The imperceptible transition from youth to old age is Hardy's theme, and the impossible task of identifying when such change takes place. Deftly then, instead of trying to locate that shift in his two representative travellers or letting them bear the weight of his metaphor, Hardy turns instead to the road itself and ends with a verse equaling craft and design to the poem's opening. "The snow feathers so gently swoop that though but half an hour ago the road was brown and now is starkly white, a watcher would have failed defining quite when it transformed it so." There were heavy snowfalls across Bitten in late December 1927, but by New Year a thaw had set in. De fugere neves. Winter Words in Various Moods and Meters was being prepared for publication, and in the introductory note Hardy had written, "So far as I am aware, I happen to be the only English poet who has brought out a new volume of his verse on his ... birthday. The number left blank, the ellipsis a ghostly omission." Hardy died on January the 11th. A.R. Ammons's tape for the turn of the year ends the previous day. Winter outlived and outwitted once more. A new almanac begun. Light and life on the horizon. Blessed hope sounded by the darkling thrush. The poet turning outwards to the galaxies and away from the warm knot in the dark. Ammons's poem has been an act of survival and escapology, a performance piece, in fact, but one performed on and at and for and with the roll of paper, one the page will reenact for us as readers. In fact, by the closing stages of tape for the turn of the year, it isn't clear whether the poet is conversing with page or page with poet, and whether reader, or poet, or page has provided the contemplative emptiness in which to think and the pristine emptiness on which to write. I've given you the interstices, the space between electrons. I've given you the dull days when turning and turning revealed nothing. I've given you the sky, uninterrupted by moon, bird, or cloud. I've given you long, uninteresting walks so you could experience vacancy. The poem or the paper ends, "Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming along. Thank you for coming along."